farce, or 105 Rust Road. A strictly factual account of the day of his diagnosis. 1. Steady Boy woke, showered and spritzed, skipped breakfast for the time being, and headed into work. Oh, what a glorious morning. Maybe. The weather in the basement was unknown. The computer required waking, made its little nibbling noises when stirred from its slumber, said its staticky hellos. The old office chair, the cold basement damp. Steady Boy had a desk calendar from 1991, a letter opener in the fashion of a gem-encrusted rapier, a ratty-ass Rolodex, and at his feet a rug. The rug, however, made moving around in the roller chair a living hell. So a sheet, listen to this, this is a true story, a sheet of stamped plastic specifically designed to facilitate the easy rolling of roller chairs in challenging terrain was purchased from Office Depot some years back by Steady Boy. Steady Boy? No one had called him that in 30, 40 years. Back then, Charlie Barnes had found it hard to keep a job, either because the pay was bad or the boss was a dick, or the work itself was a pain in the ass, and someone, an uncle probably, dubbed him Steady Boy, and the name stuck the way Tiny will stick to a big fat man. Steady Boy's knocking off early again. Steady Boy's calling in sick. That sort of thing. The paying gig that another man considered manna from heaven was, for Steady Boy, an encroachment on private land. He valued his freedom. He enjoyed his sleep. He liked to read the funny pages at his leisure. So much for all that. Steady Boy was Mr. Charles A. Barnes now, 68 years old that morning, a small businessman and father of four, and likely to live forever. 2. Ah, but it was all pretense and fakery. He was a big fat fraud. Shouldn't think like that, but it was true. God damn it was, certainly where his teeth were concerned. Other areas too, his achievements, his framed certificates, big deal. He hadn't even finished college. Hang that up on your wall, Steady Boy. Failure number one, as far as he was concerned, no college degree. Failure number two, all the times he lied about having a college degree. Failure number three, screw this. Failure number three was his reluctance to look back for too long. He was too proud and too pressed for time to be reviewing all his damn failures. We'd be here all year. Steady Boy didn't have a year. Steady Boy had cancer. That's what he had. But hey, not just any cancer. The big kahuna of cancers. Pancreatic. Heard about that one? Cancer of the pancreas is the piano that falls from the sky. You have time to glance up, maybe, then splat, like a bug on the cosmic grill. His achievements. Ha! He'd spent half his life prepping the next big thing. It never panned out. Steady Boy did not, in fact, have a hard time holding down a job. He just never wanted to be a sucker, a schlub, or a mid-level this or that. Like anyone, he had hoped to make a killing, become a household name, live forever. Well, he would not now. That was just a done deal. We really need to stop calling him Steady Boy. Good God, he thought first thing as he took a seat at his desk, the failures. All the marketing materials he still had somewhere, still shrink-wrapped, bales of the stuff. Beautiful four-color trifold brochures in service to nothing now. Nothing. His sunk costs alone could bury him alive. In pursuit of the American dream, Steady Boy had spent a small fortune on promotional ballpoints. He'd branded water bottles, keychains, stress balls. Bold Charlie Barnes would have branded his own ass with a red-hot poker to give his ideas a better shot in the marketplace. But what happened every time? Nothing happened. Without so much as a whimper, they just withered and died. 3. What do you want from me, huh? What did you expect? Those were some of the questions Steady Boy was asking that morning, after waking his computer and sitting a while with the rapier-style letter opener, contemplatively cleaning his nails. But of whom was he asking them? His children? Ex-wives? Old colleagues, maybe, like that bastard Larry Stovall. He knew Larry from his time at Bear Stearns, that scrappy brokerage firm with the dog-eat-dog mindset now kaput. He and Larry Stovall were good buddies back then. This was years ago. Charlie worked the retail desk while Larry cleared dubious trades at the direct orders of Jimmy Kane, Bear's CEO, doing God knows what damage to the moral universe. But what was it that kept Larry up at night? It wasn't boiler rooms and FTC fines. It was Charlie's affair with a nurse at First Baptist. It was fall 1992. The nurse's name was Barbara. Larry didn't like her. Didn't like the idea of her. Larry, the Oak Brook deacon, didn't give a damn about Wall Street thievery, but coveting thy neighbor's wife? Now that Larry could not abide. Human hypocrisy of this magnitude was one reason Charlie always felt far from God. Little did Larry know that that guilt-ridden affair, which ended when Charlie left Evangeline and married the nurse, sent him, for the first and only time in his life, to a therapist's couch just to pull himself together. Honestly, he'd assumed the extramarital shame would go on eating him alive, like the guy who stole fire from the gods and had his liver picked clean by birds. But did Larry offer him any comfort? Take-home pay that put Larry Stovall in the halls of Valhalla, but he still couldn't afford a little compassion for his fellow fallen man. Larry, Charlie had said, making himself vulnerable to his good old friend, I'm in real trouble here. And what did the guy do? Treated him like a fucking pariah. He set down the letter opener, picked up the phone, and dialed.
Wells Fargo, Larry Stovall's office.
So, Charlie said, Larry works for Wells now, does he? Charlie was in the roller chair on top of the slip mat that lay on top of the rug, the cordless at his ear. It had been over 15 years since he had last spoken to Larry Stovall.
He sure does, the woman said.
He was at Washington Mutual before Wells, Charlie said, and UBS before WAMU. When the woman said nothing, he added, As you can tell, I like to keep an eye on his career.
I can see that, the woman said, but unfortunately Larry hasn't quite made it into the office this morning. Can I leave a message for you?
Sure, he said. This is Charlie Barnes calling. I'm an old colleague from Bear Stearns. Can you tell Larry that I have pancreatic cancer, please? The receptionist went silent. That's Charlie Barnes, he said. Old colleague. Pancreatic cancer. Thank you. He hung up. 4. The events currently being narrated unfolded in the fall of 2008, at the start, hard as it was to believe at the time, of an era of hope and change. There was a sudden massive liquidity freeze. The banks were crumbling, the feds were scrambling, the Great Recession was on its way. It was a golden era, believe it or not, yet things were bad. People were losing their homes, their livelihoods, their nest eggs. Government bailouts followed the corporate bleeding.
The asylum, meanwhile, by which Charlie meant banking institutions, state governments, the White House, had been overtaken some time back by the inmates themselves, a slate of elected officials and their functionaries that was, to a man, entirely fucking corrupt. The reckoning at Bear Stearns had come 6 months earlier, in March. If you don't remember Bear, all the better. But make no mistake, this is a true story. Bear Stearns was once an estimable American institution, and Jimmy Kane, its hotshot CEO. Then the fifth largest investment bank on Wall Street went belly up after a single bad quarter. Hard to believe. But was it really? They were a bunch of swinging dicks getting filthy rich off risky bets in boiler rooms. Wasn't it just a matter of time? Jimmy Kane. Oh, boy. For Charlie Barnes, that man was the face of every greedy deal now coming back to haunt the country. He knew him firsthand. Had met him once, anyway. Little guy. Not much to look at, but charismatic in a bulldog way. He had swanned through the Chicago office, chomping down on one of his famous cigars on a day in 92. And it was beholding this plump, rotten, smug Jimmy Kane in the flesh that, in part, prompted Charlie to quit Bear Stearns and go out on his own the following year, specializing in retirees. Now, 15 years later, the million-dollar ideas had compounded all around him, and stacks of paper climbed his desk. He reached for the monkey's paw back scratcher he kept inside a coffee cup, claw and container branded for separate concerns but blaring the same toll-free number, and worked it between his shoulder blades, then along the pink purlieus of his salt and pepper beard. At a moment he was dying of cancer, could he get in touch with Kane, as he had just done Stovall? Odds were not good. But then Charlie darted the monkey's paw back into the coffee cup with a clatter and turned his attention to the desktop computer. After a moment's search, there was a listing for Jimmy Kane, complete with phone number and a Manhattan address, all for a $20 fee. It was like having sudden access to J. Pierpont Morgan. Steady Boy didn't have $20 just hanging around, but he did have an axe to grind. And not much else going on besides. "Good morning," he said when the caller picked up. "I'm looking for Jimmy Kane."
"Who?"
"Jimmy Kane? James Kane? Former CEO of now-defunct Bear Stearns. Is he available?"
"I'm afraid you have the wrong number," the man said.
"Hold on," he said. "I just paid $20 for this number. Are you sure?"
"There's no one here by that name."
"I'm looking for Jimmy Kane," he said. "I'm looking to give him a piece of my mind."
"There's no one here by the name of Kane."
"How dare he sell subprime mortgages to any stiff with a pulse? How dare he leverage the hell out of Bear and leave the taxpayer holding the bag? You tell him Charlie Barnes thinks he's a rat-fucking-bastard."
The man hung up. Probably hadn't cared for all the profanity. Who could blame him? Guy's going about the ordinary course of a morning, picks up the phone, and gets cursed at. But you know who that caller... He wasn't the caller. Technically, Charlie was the caller. Still, Charlie thought of him as the caller. Who that caller really wouldn't have cared for in that case? Jimmy fucking Kane, that's who. Every word out of that man's mouth was a curse. He called the man back.
"Sorry to bother you again."
"What do you want?"
"Please allow me to apologize. You answer the phone and the other guy goes off. That's not fair, but you see," he said and paused. "You see, I have pancreatic cancer."
He paused again, swiveling a little, idly smoothing back with a fingertip the desk calendar's frayed edge.
"I don't know how much you know about that particular type of cancer."
He fell silent to allow the man time to reply.
"Let me give you some idea, then," he said. "You die. They diagnose you, and a few months later, or a few weeks later, that's it. You die."
Still nothing from the man. Guess it's fair to say I'm angry. I'm still pretty young, relatively speaking.
How old are you? The man asked.
I'm 68.
There was a long pause.
That's not exactly young, the man said.
No, I suppose not. But consider this, he added. There is no silver lining with pancreatic cancer. It combines the agony of ordinary cancer with the fear and suddenness of a heart attack.
The man made no reply.
Fact of the matter is, I've spent my entire life pursuing the American dream, only to find out here at the 11th hour that it was nothing but a scam. The books were cooked. And now I'm dying. I've wasted my life.
Unbelievably, the man still had nothing to offer him.
Are you sure there's no Jimmy Kane there?
Positive.
I'll let you go, then, he said. I'm sure you have better things to do, and I don't have much time myself. Sorry again for the cursing.
Good luck to you, the man said.
Thank you,
he said, then hung up. 5. Turns out, they weren't such different men, really, Charlie Barnes and Jimmy Kane. Kane was from Evanston, outside Chicago. Charlie was born near Chicago himself. Kane played bridge. Charlie played bridge. Both men were rather vain of their bridge games. Neither Kane nor Charlie had graduated from college. Kane got his start in sales, photocopiers, then scrap iron. Charlie, too, had a career in sales, beginning, like Cy Lewis, another Bear CEO, on the sales floor of a shoe store. In Charlie's case, the store was John Arts, off East Main in the town of Danville, Illinois, where he was born in 1940. Jerry will tell you the store was Mosser's on Vermilion. It was not Mosser's. Mosser's came 2 years after John Arts. At John Arts, and later at Mosser's, Steady Boy distinguished himself. He was a hell of a shoe man, had a feel for people and a nice soft touch. Happily fell to all fours, just a squeeze and instep. His way with laces could wow the casual onlooker, and he even knew how to make the ladies with hammer toe happy. Eventually, Jimmy Kane and Charlie Barnes entered the world of high finance, both as retail brokers, Kane in 69, Charlie in 85. By the time Bush was, quote, elected, Kane, W's biggest booster, was earning $15 million a year as the CEO of Bear Stearns. Charlie's haul, as the top dog of his own concern that year, was roughly $34,000 and change. 5 years later, it was flat, while Kane's had more than doubled. The big difference seemed to be that Kane wasn't specializing exclusively in retirees. For here is where Charlie Barnes and Jimmy Kane diverged radically. Charlie wasn't willing to sell out his country just to make a buck. When he could take no more of Bear's dirty tricks, he quit. He saw how old-timers were getting fucked, quite frankly, by the conflicts of interest at all these churn-and-earn brokerage shops like Bear, where a perfectly good portfolio would be raided every 6 months for the sake of its commissions. Charlie's idea was to eschew commissions altogether in exchange for an annual fee, which would cover everything from the initial consultation and financial plan to all subsequent trades and transactions, year after year, thereby guaranteeing an honest broker. Fiduciary duty, it was called. The year Charles turned 53, he was entirely dedicated and doing noble work on behalf of the little guy, putting the era of Steady Boy permanently to bed. He called his company the Third Age Association, or TTAA. 15 years later, it remained his going concern. It paid him peanuts and brought him nothing but grief. For he currently had under management a mere 11 mil,
Sounds like a lot, maybe, but in the world of high finance, goddamn chump change. He had cobbled that money together from the cup holders and change purses of his aging clientele, and managing it barely rose to a pastime most days. He woke, moved a little money around, fielded a few phone calls, and then broke for lunch. Missed his true calling, maybe. Who knows? Squandered too much time early on, scrambling for purchase, as behind his desk he ruminatively resumes cleaning his nails with the letter opener, then hit 50 and panicked. Life was a delicate balance. If only he could have taken a breather in, say, 67, really buckled down and completed his college degree, then he might have done something with his life. He played the dilettante instead. Just ask Jerry, his oldest son. Always given him copies of religious books, Jerry, the Zen master, hoping to enlighten him. Jerry had his degree, three of them in fact. You might say Jerry was addicted to the acquiring of advanced degrees, as the light of pure reason led him out of the profane world where his father dwelled. Earning a keep. Now that proved a bit harder for Steady Boy's son. Jerry was a chip off the old block where regular employment was concerned. He loved his truer truths, but the ones he found waiting for him in the corporate world, the eternal corruptions of the modern workplace, annoying co-workers, the profit motive, disgusted and besmirched him. He always quit in a huff. Then he ran out of cash and had to take new work, only to quit again, angrier than before. Now at 49, Jerry had been forced to accept a subpar coding job for a multinational headquartered in Brussels, Belgium. He hadn't been eager to go all the way to Belgium for a paycheck, but he had alienated every HR person in corporate America by then and was in dire need of money. "Hello." "Good morning," Charlie said. "I'm looking for Jerry Barnes. May I ask who's calling?" Charlie had been expecting a formal and lilting European to answer the phone when he called the number Jerry gave him, but he got this guy instead, another American hire, he presumed. "This is Charles Barnes calling. I'm Jerry's father." "Oh, right," the guy said. "Right, no, Jerry is, Jerry just stepped away from his desk for like a minute for lunch. Can I take a message?" "A little late for lunch, isn't it? What time is it there?" As Charlie raised a starched wing under basement rafters to consult his wristwatch, a vintage Rolex, the only authentic piece in his stable of fakes, the man on the other end made no reply. "Never mind. Have Jerry call me, will you? Tell him I have news. Tell Jerry that his father has pancreatic cancer." "Pancreatic? Oh," he said to the man. "Sounds like you know a thing or two." The man went quiet. "Personally, I knew very little until just recently. Turns out it's the most aggressive of all the cancers. Hard to detect. Spreads quickly. 5% survival rate. I should have all the details later today." The man again said nothing in reply. "It's arguably the worst way anyone can die, with the exception of being hacked to death, I suppose. Tell Jerry he might want to fly home. Up to him." "I'll give him the message," the man said. "Thank you," he said. "I have to go now. I don't have much time." He hung up. If Jerry had doubted that Charlie would ever, quote, get real, if the Zen master suspected that Steady Boy would never touch some fundament of the true, which he himself was always passing back and forth between his Buddha's hands, here was the angel of death in his pancreatic disguise to prove him wrong. Charlie would not elude the long nightmare that was motherfucking reality this time around. 6. But he couldn't die just yet. He had to get out of that house first. How he hated 105 Rust Road. He had arrived there in 93, an eventful year in Steady Boy's life. He was through with Bear, had fallen in love with Barbara, finally managed to serve Evangeline divorce papers, and launched TTAA. That house was intended to be a temporary station in which to summon up the blood once more, make a killing, have his second act. Then, with Jimmy Kane like money, he would leave behind the low ceilings of 105 Rust Road, its bad carpeting and cramped bedrooms, to name just three of its odious features, and buy for his dearly beloved the house of her dreams. But TTAA hadn't panned out, and now his temporary station was turning 15 years old. He knew he was lucky to have it, just as the banks were foreclosing on so many others. But would he die there? Would he really go to his grave? Right there in the house on Rust Road? Not if this new idea of his was as good as he believed it to be. He needed only a name, a tagline, a logo, a trademark, a color palette, a marketing plan, an angel investor or two, so much to do. Then he recalled that he could strike one of those line items from the list, as the perfect name had come to him during the previous night's tossing and turning, all in a flash. Chipping in. "I'd like to send a Word doc your way," he said in the next phone call he made that morning, intended to get all good things rolling. "An idea still in its planning stages, so go easy on me. But give me your gut, too, if you don't mind. Do you mind?"
"I don't mind," Rudy said.
His kid brother, 2 years his junior, Rudy lived in Tucson, Arizona, but Steady Boy could still see him clearly. Skeptical brow furrowed like a hound dog's, flaring nostrils one cup size too large for the slender stem of his nose. Charlie didn't want to burden him with the bad news. If Rudy, their mother's favorite, knew Charlie was sick or dying, it would quickly derail the conversation, for his brother was a quack who ran an online venue for vitamin supplements and miracle cures. Charlie didn't need some dubious regimen. He needed honest feedback.
"Sending now," he said. "Call you later." He hung up.
7. He stepped away for a quick bite, walked up the stairs to the kitchen. That's right. 15 years after leaving Bear, he was still headquartered between a clothing rack full of winter coats and a Whirlpool dryer. The only honest boiler room in the brokerage business. Honesty tossed you down the basement stairs, and no amount of whimpering would persuade the gatekeeper to let you up again, to feel the sun, breathe fresh air, and take a much-needed piss on the green, green grass. An honest man was a damn dog in this world, made to heal and told to stay put, while the dishonest man got filthy stinking rich and stuck the country with the tab. He went outside to retrieve the morning paper. As he emerged from under the portico, the bright day bushwhacked him. The warmth percolated, pricking him. Steady Boy paused, lifted his face to the sun. He felt a little drunk. He was present, in heat like that, at the launch of Apollo 11. He felt the same heat 10 years later on a rare vacation under a Florida palm. He ran naked in summer as a little boy. He shucked corn during an Illinois drought. He watched his pebbly footprints evaporate behind him on the poolside concrete. He rode in a canoe under a canopy of trees as a trickle of sunlight danced over the water, as elsewhere in memory it did over old barnyards and forest floors. A thundering, brain-clearing sneeze, exquisite in every way, followed in the next instant, and he opened his eyes and carried on in the shuddering aftermath to the curb and the Chicago Tribune. On his way back up the drive, he was filled with rage again, briefly, as he read the headline through the blue plastic sleeve. It was a terrible time to be dying, what with the world and the crapper. He took it personally. For what did any of it matter? What was the point of life if you couldn't sense, however dimly, that we were making progress? Almost instantly, he recalled his son. No, not Jerry. Jerry's younger brother, the boy called Jake. Of all his children, Jake represented Charlie's own private hope and change, with his intelligence, his eloquence, his handsome... wasn't picking up. Having regained the portico, a concrete slab one step up from the lawn, Charlie turned to survey the neighborhood while Jake's voicemail greeting played in his ear. Ordinarily a suburban blight, there were tarred cracks all down the asphalt and cheap chain-link fencing around not always the best yards, and crabgrass burned to a crisp and rusted grates to catch the rainbow runoff. Rust Road looked almost beautiful that morning, tranquil, even, as birdsong and blue sky made him grateful to be out of the basement. He left a message for his son, then speed-dialed his daughter. Let's call her Marcy, who lived, let's say, in Deer Park, Texas. She was a good person, this Marcy, though she was also quick to anger and reluctant to medicate. You just never knew which Marcy you were going to get, the sweet, docile Marcy who exhibited the decency of all the best daughters, or the standard-issue Karen, who did not give a fuck and delighted in tormenting a one-armed kid by holding him down and dangling saliva over his face in a faraway Florida of the distant past.
Kinder Morgan, Bethany speaking.
Good morning, Bethany. Charles Barnes calling. I'm looking for Marcy Mahoney.
Could it be Marcy Barnes you want?
Marcy, who worked as an operations manager for an energy company, had divorced so often herself that Steady Boy could hardly be expected to keep straight what surname she was going by on any given day.
That's the one, he said. Didn't know she'd return to her maiden name. Is she available?
I'm afraid Marcy's on site today. May I take a message?
I guess you can, sure. This is her father calling. Can you tell Marcy that her father has pancreatic cancer, please? You might know something about pancreatic cancer, Bethany. I never like to presume.
There was a long pause.
I don't know anything about it, she said.
Well, I can tell you this, it's not good. People with pancreatic cancer go to their graves as if shot out of a cannon, okay? Hospital personnel can hardly collect a gurney quickly enough to send that particular patient off to hospice care before he keels over right there in the lobby of the hospital. You want to know what it's like?
There was a long pause.
I'm sorry, are you asking?
It's like priority mail, he said. It gets you where you're going faster than the other methods, but you have to pay extra. In fear, I mean, and the surprise factor, and physical devastation. There's no time to make amends or settle your accounts. You just die.
I will be sure to give Marcy this message right away, Bethany said.
Thank you, he said. Odds are she won't know much about pancreatic cancer. Ask her to do a simple Google search. 2 minutes should be more than enough.
I will absolutely give her this message the minute she comes back into the office.
But what I really need her to do is to fly into O'Hare. I'd happily pick her up, take her to lunch. Her stepmother will be of enormous help to me during this time, but there are one or two things I can't ask her stepmother to do. Her stepmother has to work. She's an ER nurse. She can't take off as easily as Marcy can.
Ideally, Marcy would set aside this silly little beef she has with her stepmother, and then everyone could come together like family. The doctor will be calling me later today to give me the rundown. It's not going to be pretty. In the meantime, I'm hoping Marcy will look into making the necessary arrangements. I know there are no guarantees, but tell her that I'm really looking forward to seeing her in Chicago.
There was a long pause.
Are you sure you wouldn't prefer to tell her all this yourself?
Bethany asked. I don't think so, he said.
Upon further reflection, he added,
No, definitely not.
He hung up. 8. Sure, he'd married young. 19 years old. Just ridiculous. The only way they could, you know. Although technically, little Jerry was already on his way. Just a real different time back then. Totally different world. Yeah, they'd divorced. Of course they had. They were a bad match. Still kids themselves when Jerry came along. A recipe for unhappiness all around. You know the score. No one could blame Jerry for holding a grudge. Then, in 1970, he met the woman of his dreams, his life partner, his soulmate. Just kidding. His second marriage, forged over whiskeys at 810 tap, was a classic rebound and lasted all of 6 months. Her name was identical to his current wife's. She was the first of his two Barbaras, Barbara LaFirst. It was the third time's the charm for Charlie Barnes. A revision, forsooth. Each divorce a discarded draft, every remarriage a fresh page upon which to write a new story, this time with a happy ending. We will meet each of his ex-wives in due course. Right now, it is enough to convey the fact, the indisputable fact, that he was indeed married a total of 5 times. Despite a tendency among certain people to revise that number downward, to reconfigure an epic cast so that a perfect shit show might be retold as a pretty little fairy tale. Never mind. The facts speak for themselves. His third wife was fatefully named Charlie, with a Y. Note, however, the minor yet tantalizing variant spelling, which effeminized his ho-hum handle to such wild sensual effect that it drove him crazy just thinking about it. They were Charlie and Charlie of Danville, Illinois. Charlie was a local beauty. She looked just like Allie McGraw in Love Story, although her confidence and sass were more in keeping with the sitcom star of the day, that Mary Tyler Moore. He was madly in love. But then Charlie Prophet of Peoria, Illinois, decided to start fucking someone new. So the third time wasn't the charm for Charlie Barnes after all. You had to marvel that he would marry a fourth time, let alone a fifth. But hope springeth eternal, and where hope is, change can't be far behind. His fifth marriage was alive and well, and not simply because time-wise pancreatic cancer will always move faster than divorce proceedings. With his earlier wives, he was a work in progress. A scoundrel to some, a salvage job to others, a real slow learner all around. But here he was, with the nurse at First Baptist, in a successful union at last. The kids didn't care for her much, especially Marcy in a bad mood, but he couldn't worry about that. He had this one thing going for him, and he wouldn't fuck it up for the world. Hello, young man, she said. Speak of the devil. It was Barbara calling from the hospital. He spoke to her via the wall-mounted landline in the kitchen. 49 that May, she was 3 days older than his eldest son and 3 days younger than his fourth ex-wife. An awkward bit of coincidence, better never to bring up in conversation.
Barbara preferred no talk of Evangeline whatsoever, in fact wished to blot out of existence all of Charlie's romantic history. It diluted the dream.
Hello, young lady.
And what are you up to this morning?
Oh, not much.
Thinking about Jimmy Kane again?
Boy, did she have him pegged. He swiveled around with the cord in hand.
Honey, he said, I'm under the gun here. Do you really think I have time to be thinking about that Rat Fink bastard?
She didn't immediately reply.
But did you know, he said, that to kick off his long weekends, get this, oh boy, this burns my ass, to kick off his long weekends, the almighty Jimmy Kane would leave his office in Midtown Manhattan on Thursday at noon by helicopter, Barbara, at $1,700 a pop, just so that he could play a round of golf in New Jersey before it got dark? Same man who then demanded a taxpayer bailout!
He drifted off after that into a bitter reverie about Jimmy Kane.
And there's plenty more where that came from, he added.
I don't doubt it, she said.
Barbara was a workaholic with a single outside interest, her husband's well-being. She was eager to hear the latest from the doctor and to get her hands on the raw data from Charlie's recent round of tests to do her own interpreting. She was quite clever, this Barbara Ledoux, despite however Marcy might feel about her. At the same time, it was a busy morning inside the emergency room. A tall man with a parrot on his shoulder had just appeared before the triage window, bleeding from the hand.
What have you heard from the doctor, Chuck?
Nothing yet, he said, fighting a dizzy spell brought on by his reverie. Listen, young lady, some of us are out here trying to play fair. We're trying to play by the rules. And we're meeting with resistance because the damn game is fixed. I never knew it before, but the dice are loaded in favor of the rat bastards who lie, cheat, and steal. If you don't keep that in mind, you could attribute a lot of these disparities, in compensation, I mean, and media attention, that sort of thing, simply to personal failing.
I think you're doing just fine, she said.
Do you?
I do.
His first handful of wives would not have agreed. They would have wanted him to interrogate those personal failings a bit more. Matter of fact, they'd have gone so far as to insist that the game was not rigged, and that Charlie's gripe was a convenience meant to obscure his preoccupation with other things, like his hard-ons, the sports page, trips to the mall, workday matinees, and afternoon naps. They saw his failings crystal clear, while missing the bigger picture. Barbara saw the bigger picture.
Love you, he said.
Love you too, she said. Call me when you know more.
9. His lower back pain was a function of bad posture. His rare headache was always the result of too much beer. Otherwise, he was healthy. But he had smoked for years, which haunted him. How he loved to smoke. Pulling the lever on the cigarette dispenser, he's back at 810 tap, the man in midwinter, all mutton chops and wool, retrieving the new pack amid neon and noise, and packing it still tighter against his palm before tearing into it, first the ring of gold plastic, followed by the square of silver foil. He would then gently pry out the first of those intoxicating cylinders and pass it under his nose for a woodsy whiff of tobacco. It was all such a sensuous delight, and this long before he'd taken the first puff. He kicked the habit with everyone else sometime during Carter's only term when the evidence became irrefutable and overwhelming. And after which no one ever smoked another cigarette again. Cancer was canceled. He put it completely out of mind.
Years later, walking down the street, if he saw a pretty young lady puffing away, he would not hesitate to go straight up to her and caution her, hector her, chide her. For she had her whole damn life ahead of her, and all that youth and all that beauty. God, how he loved beauty. He was enthralled to it. He lived and died by it, and there beauty was, blackening her lungs. It broke his heart. Trouble was, he'd recently weighed himself. Since losing his teeth at the age of 24, a mortal misfortune in its own right, his dentist, a Dr. Paul O'Rourke of Bethlehem Dental, had pulled 22 in one go, an absolute hell, before fitting him for a pair of dentures, whereupon he gained 30 pounds overnight because he could chew solid food again without pain. Since then, Charlie never moved on the weight scale more than 3 pounds in either direction. It was not for a lack of effort. He zipped through double cheeseburgers. He inhaled racks of ribs. He ate like hell morning and night. And yet, what followed the bloody civil war in his poor, rotted mouth was 4 decades of good, solid health. Then, the last 2 weeks of July rolled around, and he lost 9 pounds. It was a decline unaccompanied by other symptoms, or even an apparent cause. Some portion of him simply vanished, was vanishing still.
So what do you think?
About?
My new idea, he said,
having discovered that he had returned to the kitchen landline and dialed his kid brother's number without really being aware of it or knowing why.
My chipping in.
Charlie, Rudy said, it's only been half an hour since you sent me that doc. Rudy made a pretty good nut selling water pills and horse powders to the internet's deluded desperate. In the past, when Charlie complained of some bane or ailment, Rudy would gift him with whatever vitamin supplements available on his website that he believed would cure the complaint, as well as extend Charlie's life expectancy, as if that were the goal. He could well remember once opening a box from Tucson and finding, among the 10 or so bottles of obscure enzymes and hard-to-pronounce amino acids, one clearly marked, for canine use only.
Turns out, Rudy, I'm in a real hurry.
Why the rush, Charlie? Should he come clean? He didn't think so. He didn't want pity points just because he was dying.
Eager to get it off the ground, that's all.
Chipping in, Rudy said.
That's right, chipping in.
In the silence that followed, the gloom pressed in on him from every direction, and with the landline at his ear, he drifted out of the kitchen, but could go only so far on account of the cord. The one thing he found enlivening the dull suburban sitting room into which he stepped was, in his opinion, the crossword puzzle on the coffee table. Companionably filled out in his and Barbara's hand the weekend before, and left unfinished, the stubby pencil abandoned in the paper's hollow. They had been stymied by 48 across, experts at exports. After clawing T-R-U-T-H into the light of day, they could take the clue no further, and their efforts fizzled. Nevertheless, that puzzle represented 2 contented hours with his hard-working wife, who that Sunday morning had made her famous coffee cake. On the table next to the puzzle, between 2 cheap bookends, sat a small collection of novels, one written by his son, which Charlie had endeavored to finish more than once to no avail. "Sorry, Charlie, you gotta give me a little more time here," Rudy replied. I'm still working on my morning Joe.
Tell you what, he said. You call me when you're ready. I won't bother you again.
10. In the east-facing kitchen, where the sunlight at that hour fell in a single polygon of heat through the sliding glass doors, he put things in order. He sealed off the natural light by closing the Venetian blinds.
Then he turned on the overhead light, encased in its stained glass dome, to create a more mellow, artificial morning. He collected the bowl, followed by the spoon, before crunching something underfoot, a bit of egg noodle, which cracked and scattered, as he retrieved the skim milk from the fridge. He made room for himself at the crowded kitchen table, where he sat eating his breakfast while nibbling away at columns of newsprint, the sports page to begin, followed on Fridays by the movie reviews. It was impossible, however, for Steady Boy to resist the conclusion that he was a big fat failure in life. He tried to stay focused on slicing and dicing with his expert spoon, those deliriously addictive crunchy O's in their sweet cold milk, but he was slowly consumed by terror. His efforts had never been enough. When they were enough, they were wrongly directed. On those rare occasions when his every effort was perfectly on the mark, his timing sucked. When his timing was right, he lacked the funds. When the funds came through, he botched the execution. When the execution was seamless, the market failed to materialize. But no, there was always a market. It just wanted something different, something better, something unsoiled by his clumsy hands. All he touched turned to shit. He was born a nobody, and that's how he would die. He abandoned his breakfast and walked out of the house. He was coming, he was going, he didn't know what the fuck he was doing. He was just out there, under the sun. He'd enjoyed it a minute ago, felt intoxicated by a sneeze. Now, nowhere did the world seem drearier. Rust Road was a nasty little strip of crumbling blacktop, a diseased tongue, the bowels of the earth saying, "Ah!" All down the block, blacktop and garbage toters and rusting minivans and telephone lines and the shadows of telephone lines. Each house, one selfsame suburban ranch after another, was invariably set too close to its neighbor. Planes dropping into O'Hare flew directly overhead, 1,000 daily Boeings skimming the rooftops. One was descending even now. He could taste its exhaust. This was no one's idea of a final resting place, but he would die here. He would die in that house. A neighbor loading up his minivan across the street turned at the peripheral agitation of an old man describing small circles in his driveway while muttering to himself. Charlie hadn't seen him at first. Now he felt like a jerk. He stopped circling on a dime and waved. Pretense and fakery. Nothing to see here, friend. No one losing his fucking mind in a mortal panic. Now, knowing Steady Boy as well as I do, I know he will want to save face. But what action will he take to... Ordinarily, in a work of fiction, one is free to move a character around at will, to swap the cat in the window for a dog at his feet, outfit him with a cardigan, or, considering the heat, blink away the cardigan, while dampening the pits of his button down, force the feds to pull up and place him under arrest for securities fraud, or, knowing his heart, his scrupulous heart, tweak the SWAT team into something more fantastical, like that trio of meticulously dressed sponsors of million-dollar sweepstakes, the cameraman, the notary, and the nice lady in pearls, appearing out of the blue with an oversized check. Charlie rescued. Charlie redeemed. It is even ordinarily within my power to have Hover with no advance warning and capable of being observed by Charlie alone, a lenticular UFO over the skies of Schaumburg, beaming him up from Rust Road so that he might bow out of this mortal little game without playing by its rules, which was his private wish. But I promised the old man to tell it straight this time, to stick to the facts for once, to abide by the historical record,
and to exercise the discipline imposed by real life, the, quote, harsh truth in Stendhal's phrase, which has always been so loathsome to us both. Pivoting, he walked to the mailbox. He opened it. He peered inside. Finding the nothing he knew would be waiting, he closed it up again. In that way, he feigned for the neighbor a greater purpose for being outside than resisting an ugly fate at his kitchen table. Then he tramped back up the drive and into the house. True story. 11. His career as a working stiff began, for all intents and purposes, on a night in October of 1956, when a young lady named Sue Starter walked by him at a high school football game as he was picking his nose in the middle of a dreamy youth. Against all odds, she found him fetching enough in his buzz cut and bib overalls to make a demand.
"Buy me a Coke," she said.
His reply was a dumb and startled look.
"Who, me?" "What's the matter?" she asked him. "Don't you got any money?"
Well, hell no, he didn't have any money. He had a curfew and a birthday, the sum total of his worldly possessions in 1956, and an indication of his sweeping power. At the sound of Sue's voice, he woke from his boyhood as if stepping through an interdimensional shimmer, dividing before from after, dreamer from damned, and vowed there and then to get a job. Before long, there were more demands just like it. "Buy me a milkshake, Charlie. Buy me a cheeseburger. Buy me those shoes in the window. Let's go to the dance, Charlie. Let's go to the movies. Let's go to the state fair." Let's have a closer look at Sue. Appearance-wise, Jerry's mother was a dark dream with full lips and almond eyes. Fashion-wise, she spared no expense but looked as conservative as all the rest. In terms of morals, she was entirely conventional. In personality, a flirt, in outlook, a skeptic, in disposition, a bleak and dire depressive, in political mindset, more progressive than most. In matters of sex, boldly forward, then discreetly withholding. She was mercurial at parties and dances, a charmer one night, a mute the next, in love a total slave, but as an object of a man's desire, she was a merciless and cunning manipulator. If her kindness was subject to moods, she had her table manners down cold, and her telephone etiquette was impeccable. Charlie knew as much because within a week of their first encounter, he had called her residence to let her know that he was bundling and delivering the Danville Commercial News for 4 bits a week plus tips. Would she like to go out on a date with him? He would not last long as a paper boy, 4 months by his current reckoning. At the time, it felt like an ice age, waking in the pre-dawn in the heart of winter, sick to his stomach from lack of sleep, pedaling through the freezing dark and wanting to die long before bundling the first of those morning editions. He started looking for a new job almost immediately. By the time he graduated from high school, he'd worked at a poultry farm, a lumber yard, the Lauhoff Grain Mill on North Avenue, and the refractory plant in Tilton, a 2 mile walk. Never a calling, these jobs. Thrilling at first with the promise of more pay and future potential, they soon grew dull and proved short-lived, premised as they were on a simple exchange, my time for your money. Not even good money, really. 1 cent a bushel, 2 bits an hour, $3 a day. But what amounted to pocket change and gave him a taste of power ended up blinding Charlie for too long. False god, foreclosing on too much. A college education, a law school degree, partnership at a law firm, pictured as a crystal decanter on a mahogany bar cart, or perhaps some steady climb up the corporate ladder, a place in the academy or in the halls of power. More damnably still,
Pocket change prevented him from seeking any ticket out of that dead-end town, as he was convinced he wanted what tethered him to Danville, a wife and child at age 19. Happily, he took jobs, quit jobs, got fired, walked into storage closets and meat lockers, forgetting what he came for, his mind always on some more palpable dream. Courtship, adults called it. It was, quote, necking to teenagers. Among sophisticates, quote, lovemaking. To young Charlie, it was a barnyard urge, and it would determine entirely the first decade of his adult life. When he looked back on those lost years, he could only shake his head. Other boys managed to overcome it, moving with alacrity out of the barnyard into lecture halls, conference rooms, military bases, you name it, where instead of indulging it, you could tease out its marketing power or write treatises on its role in history, making real money in the process. Charlie kilned brick instead, hauled lumber, flipped burgers, made ballast, sluiced cow guts off tile walls, attached castings to chassis at the GM plant, coated fiberglass for T-Pack, sorted jellied candies on a conveyor belt, and drove a truck for Fred Amond out of Hoopston before finally putting on a suit and tie to sell shoes for Mr. Johnart, all in the name of keeping his young wife as happy as fate would allow, so that he might continue to get laid. She was never all that happy. He was holding Jerry in his arms before work one morning, pointing out squirrels through the kitchen window, when she told him she hated her life, hated him and the baby too. Jerry wasn't yet a year old. Then she confessed through tears that she was in love with someone else. Blew his fucking mind. Pretense and fakery. Was anything real?
I love Marshall, she kept saying. I don't love you, I love Marshall.
Who the fuck was Marshall? Marshall Giacone, who ran the ball for Westville the year they took state. Charlie didn't stand a chance. He was devastated, angry, confused. If Buy Me a Coke had barged into a boyhood dream, permanently waking him to some greater reality, I'm in love with Marshall, inaugurated him into the living nightmare that adult life could be. Deception, shattered dreams, the heavy burdens of parenthood, and Charlie Barnes, at 20, still secretly a boy himself.
I'm in love with Marshall, should have spelled the end of his union with Sue Starter, but it dragged on another 10 years. 10 more years.
12. 10 minutes later, he dumped the bowl of cereal that had gone soggy during his time outside, poured a fresh bowl, his third, and took up the newspaper again, somehow managing this time to remain seated. He soon found himself absorbed in another round of reporting on subprime mortgages, collateralized debt obligations, and the collapse of the global economy when the power went out. He looked up. The overhead light was dead and the radio had ceased mid-song. He glanced at the microwave to his right, down the sunnier side of which a thirsty philodendron unfurled. The blank display confirmed it. The room was suspended, irrevocably it seemed, in a monochromatic lifelessness he didn't care for one bit. It felt like someone had come along and tossed a dust cloth over the entire room, including the human being at the center of it, as if to say, now just imagine it like this for all eternity, and you have your fate. He was begging the light to reignite, the music to burst forth again, the status quo to go on and on and on, when the phone, the wall-mounted landline he used to call Rudy, began to ring. It was that line his doctor would be calling to offer his update. He didn't immediately answer. Later, he would play back this hesitation,
really this revelation, and break it down into its component parts. Slice the experience finer and finer, while praying to God that it never recurred. But in real time, there was only the raw, unfortunate thought which arrived in a flash. I would rather go insane. For the insane know something that Charlie intuited at the phone's first mighty roar. And what exactly was it that Charlie knew? I've asked myself that question many times. And though I've never taken prescription medication for a mental illness or spent time in a locked ward, if I were to hazard a guess, I'd say it comes down to this. Engagement is optional. No one asks to be born. But once here, we elect to remain, or not. Suicide might seem to most like the epitome of crazy, but to a different subset, it is sanity disguised. The freedom to disengage from everyday life never occurs to the well-adjusted, as they go about busily pursuing their fortunes, starting their families, and completing their adventures in living color. But it is murmuring from the basement, whispering from the cell, screaming from the walls of the asylum all the while. Until the power blinked off and the phone began to ring, Charlie was in it, one among oblivious millions. He answered the door. He rotated his tires. He obeyed garbage night. But when the ringing phone required his further participation in life, for the first time he hung back, wondering, why give it? It reminds me, as it did him at the time, of something similar in the historical record, only of less consequence. The year was 1953. Charlie Boy to his mother, Chi-Chi to his little brother, Steady Boy was 13, the year he fell in love with the game of basketball. The whole memory descended as the phone rang a second time, as if its horrible scream were also a most delicate summons. Intact again, sturdy even, were his two rickety knees, his earliest hopes and dreams. The ball, a gift wrapped in soft leather, contained more marvels and mysteries than a spinning globe. One fun trick was to bounce it hard on the blacktop at just the right angle so as to send it through the hoop on its downward journey. It hardly mattered that he failed once to move out of the way in time and the ball came for him, pile-driving his nose into his brains and making his ears ring. Even the game's treacheries were beguiling. That summer, he would stir at the break of dawn and, with one whole foot still in some dream, recall the basketball. His eyes would ping open, and he would reach out and begin dribbling at his bedside in the half-dark, regardless of who might still be sleeping. His mother, a constant confiscator of that ball, would sit up from a dead sleep and move her head bird-like, while the unhappy lump lying next to her, Charlie saw this perfectly in his mind's eye 55 years later, prepared to answer the debt collector's rhythmic knock in a swiftly souring dream of his own. Into that bright dawn and new day, and into the long, luxurious afternoon that leafed its green hours in great abundance, Charlie dribbled, man. Frank Santa Croce, the grocer's son, whose mother purchased for him a pristine white pair of Chuck Taylor All-Stars with sure-foot suction soles, and whose father built him a hoop behind the family store, might have shot the ball better, might have scored more points, but Charlie was the ball handler. A whisper, a whoosh, a rumor of a ghost, Charlie faked and went by Frank every time. It was with the confidence earned from his one-on-one games against Frank that he entered the court during junior varsity tryouts his freshman year of high school, believing no other dribbler at Danville High could beat him. The coach, one Stan Butkus,
a World War II vet with a fused spine that prevented him from bending over, so that at least once every practice he would stiffly kick some errant ball to kingdom come, as if out of sheer instinct, regarded Charlie that day as though he liked what he saw.
"Very good, son,"
he said with all the loose baller jive of an iron rod.
"Now show me what you can do with your other hand."
"My other hand, sir?"
"Your left hand, son. Pass the ball between both hands."
Both hands. It had never occurred to Charlie to regard that as an option. Why give over to the left hand what the right did with such grace? "I could try it, sir, I guess," he said, and promptly had the ball stolen from him by some showboat who had no right to leap out like that. The whole clutch followed after, leaving him alone to notice, at midcourt, all the two-handed dribbling going on. Was that really how dribbling was done? As it turned out, there were rules, customs, advanced techniques, all very difficult to master. He did try. He fell in line, ran drills, did all he could to overcome the awkwardness of two-handed dribbling until, exhibiting no great improvement, benched most games and turning bitter toward the ball, he dropped out, gave it up, joined the dramatics club instead. It proved a better fit. And now, as the phone shrieked a third extra long time, demanding he talk to the doctor, whose requirements for further life were bound to be more exacting than Coach Butkus's sporting demands from half a century prior, he wanted to drop out with that same sigh of insufficiency and mournful wising up that tainted the end of his brief devotion to basketball. But drop out of life? There would be no dramatics club waiting in the wings, while suicide would only hasten what he hoped to forestall. Bowing out could only mean a break with reality, opening a trapdoor in the stage somewhere and laughing. Laughing while falling down a chute into a fiction. He stood and answered the phone. This was, without a doubt, what I admired most about Steady Boy in his decline. He did not quit. And look, we see how he flirted just now with madness, how little that appealed to him in the end, how he stood to participate still more in the game of life, in spite of its promise to reveal its most demanding rigor yet. He would not bow out, go nuts. And yet, by the popular definition of that state of mind, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, Charlie had been effectively insane since about 1960, when he first began making cold calls, licking envelopes, registering trademarks, handing out business cards, drawing up marketing plans, and giving it his all according to his lights, yet never making any progress that he could discern. Let me tell you something about this man. He had heart. "Dr. Skinnaman?" he asked timidly upon answering the phone. A woman's voice replied, "No." He was instantly relieved. "Oh, thank God," he said. He didn't really have any desire to hear from the doctor who would be calling, or any doctor, ever, about his condition, the future, anything, and breathed easy again.
"I'm calling for Charles Barnes," said the voice.
"Speaking."
"This is Sophie Crowder, Charles. I'm Evelyn Crowder's daughter-in-law. I'm afraid I have some bad news," she said. "Evelyn passed away in the night."
A name. A mere name to you and me. But to Charlie, a client of 23 years, and the representative figure of his change in fortune, when at last he came north to Chicago and took a job with Dean Witter, Bear's precursor, and started realizing some of his potential in life.
A short, sweet old lady, without an ounce of investing acumen, Evelyn had appeared before the Dean Witter kiosk inside a Sears Anchor store in the Oakbrook Mall, where she removed one stiff, green $100 bill after another for a total of $27,000 from her ostrich hide purse, inquiring if there might be some better way of keeping it safe. In the intervening years, he had grown Evelyn Crowder's $27,000 to a wisely allocated $130,000.
"Oh, no," he said. "This is terrible. This is terrible."
"Charles?"
"This is terrible," he repeated. "What happened?"
"We believe it was a heart attack."
He squatted down with the phone at his ear. Had to seek a lower center of gravity at the dizzying news. Death. Poor Evelyn, poor human being. The tears were spontaneous and unexpected. He had loved her. Always an old lady, heavily rouged and scented, clueless and far too trusting, but entirely innocent, beautiful, and lovable. Poor thing. Had to have been scared, late at night, dying alone. "Call me night or day," he tended to say, upon ending a phone call with a client. Had she tried to call?
"Charlie, I think I might be dying."
Without knowing it, he took up a bit of the cracked egg noodle near at hand, close as he was to the floor, and worried it between his fingers as he tried to fix his mind on the elusive fact. It ends. It all ends. Unimaginable.
"This is a complete shock," he said. "I really love your mother-in-law. She's been a loyal client of mine for years."
"It's a shock for us, too," she said.
"Can I ask you to hold on a second, Charles?"
When she returned a minute later, she gave him the name of a funeral home and the date and time of the service before quickly getting off the phone. He collected himself and stood. His head was spinning. 13. As it happened, he would not make it to Evelyn Crowder's funeral. As more pressing concerns, private disasters, moved in, Evelyn Crowder would slip from his mind. In the meantime, there was sadness, there was reflection, and there was panic. Evelyn's money would likely go away now, dispersed among her heirs, and with it Charlie's custodial fees. And hers was not the only account he had lost of late. His clients were restless. Their holdings were down. Some were ill-advisedly pulling their assets and, in the process, destroying his business. He hated 105 Rust Road, but it did not follow that he wished to be evicted from its scuffed and tired walls. Even with pancreatic cancer, they weren't going to let him live. He would be homeless. He would come to nothing as he had always feared and die on the streets in disgrace. 68 years old. This goddamn life. I have failed to mention that while Charlie was outside pacing during an earlier moment of panic, forced by the neighbor's gaze to feign a search of his mailbox, he expected to find in that silver tomb with the tight-fitting lid nothing at all, since he diligently collected the mail at the same time every day. And if initially I suggested that he did find nothing and walked back inside empty-handed, that was only to instill in the reader right now the same surprise Charlie experienced back then, at finding, in fact, a single white, mildly weathered item deposited the night before by a neighbor who had received it by accident. The only time I intend to be playful in this otherwise true account. It was a payment due notice from a Dallas collection agency addressed to Charles Barnes. He had torn into it, and it made him mad. A misbegotten charge for a trial period he never canceled, for a service he never used. He tossed it in the trash and planned to ignore it,
But then, news of Evelyn's death sent his fearful heart dominoing from one worry to the next, culminating now in his pulling the letter from the can, brushing off the cereal and the coffee grounds, picking up the phone he cradled only a minute earlier, and dialing the toll-free number.
Credence, credit.
You people have a lot of nerve, he began.
Name, please.
Name, case number, and a long wait later, he was finally transferred to his case manager, to whom he tried to explain why he didn't owe upwards of $340 to Platinum Warranty, Inc., or its agents at Credence Credit Corp.
Why don't you take a deep breath, sir?
The debt collector suggested.
Don't you dare tell me to take a deep breath. You're not the one facing eviction and death here.
Eviction and death?
That's right, asshole. Your $300 adds up. And I have pancreatic cancer. You know anything about that?
Don't imagine you do.
It starves you, then it wastes you, then it drowns you. Sound familiar? It sure should, because you are the pancreatic cancer of the capitalist system. You offer no warning, no appeal, no logic, no fairness, no mercy, just ultimatums and punishment. Do you think I have time for this? But here I am, forced to spend my precious few remaining...
He was getting another call.
Can I ask you to hold, please?
Sure.
He clicked over.
Charles Barnes?
Yes.
This is Nurse Keeler calling from Dr. Skinneman's office.
His heart instantly kicked. The dizzy spell returned.
How are you this morning?
Fine, he said, in a voice far less confident than the one he had just deployed to curse out his case manager.
I guess.
We have received your test results, and the doctor has had a chance to look them over.
Okay.
Your scans are clean. Your numbers look great. The doctor was very pleased.
There was a long pause.
Beg your pardon?
No need for a follow-up.
Hold on, he said. What are you saying? That I don't have pancreatic cancer?
You don't have cancer of any kind,
the nurse said. There was another long pause.
You're clean as a whistle.
But the weight loss... he said.
The what?
The weight loss.
Oh, the nurse said. Who knows? That could be anything.
He made good on his wife's request that he take down the raw numbers on the test results, which he did on the first thing at hand, a little white napkin. 14. It was the fucking internet. Barbara, who knew better, had told him to steer clear of that goddamn thing. Had he listened? No. In the disquieting days following his appointment with Dr. Skinneman and his battery of tests, he'd lost all perspective and given way to fear. He went on that machine day and night, read every last user post and grim prognostication, and every symptom described him to a T. Pancreatic cancer. C'est moi. Boy, was he relieved. But he was also a little, well, embarrassed now for having told a few select people that he was as good as dead, basically, goddammit. He thought he should probably call Jerry back and Marcy too and maybe a few others and tell them the good news. But the phone was already ringing.
Hello?
You were saying, Mr. Barnes? It was his case manager from the collection agency. It appeared their connection had never been broken.
You again,
he said. He liked it better when he had pancreatic cancer. Not really, of course, that was absurd. But he did enjoy the clarity it gave him. A deadly cancer like that will put things in perspective and everyone in their place. Now he had to go back to being just another everyday schlub paying down debts from a basement office. Who cared about that guy? In this world, a perfectly healthy man could either make ends meet or fuck off and die.
I'm gonna have to call you back,
he said. He hung up. One thing you have to keep in mind about Steady Boy. If my father was something of a joke, he was also a fucking colossus. There was no bringing him down, no killing him off. Recall the gods that dwelled upon Mount Olympus. They, too, could be easily mocked by the poets and their lives described in terms of farce, because they were immortal. 15. He had a seat at the kitchen table to gather his wits. So he would not die. He would live, forced by good health to continue to participate sanely in all of life's ways. Try again. Fail? That too, probably, if history were any guide. It had been, he supposed, kind of nice to think it was all over with, briefly, his ongoing effort. Now, he had a lot of time on his hands. A whole lot of time. What to do with it? Turn everything around, of course.
Yes, success. There was always that. The second act. Getting the hell out of that basement office and buying the nurse at First Baptist, who deserved better, a new house. Something befitting the high regard in which he held them both. The power returned, and with it, the kitchen light, the radio, the microwave display now blinking, the hum of the refrigerator, and a palpably renewed sense of animation, of life, that was somehow greater than the sum of its parts. But Charlie himself didn't brighten. He had begged the power to come back on when it seemed to be staging a dress rehearsal for biting the big one. Now, there was too much light shining down on the old dull things. The kitchen, in need of renovating. The house he would never escape. The narrowness of a life that was incomplete at 68, but that could not be changed or improved, no matter the effort he made. He would die in that house. The phone began to ring again. It was his kid brother, Rudy.
Just finished my Joe, Charlie, and been reading over that document you sent me.
Uh-huh.
You're chipping in.
Right,
he said. You asked me to give you my gut.
Go ahead, he said.
There was a long pause. What's wrong, Charlie? You sound low.
Dumb move to hand that man a dream. If Charlie, who would live now, not die, and who needed a dream to live by, had to hear, even from a know-nothing peddler of dog pills like his brother, that his chipping in was bad. It was doomed. It would go to hell like his other ideas. He might really go nuts indeed, take matters into his own hands, and make the quick death that was pancreatic cancer look like a protracted war, by putting a gun to his head and blowing his fucking brains out. He couldn't risk that. So when his poor brother, put upon all morning, began to speak, Charlie quietly hung up on him. How I might wish it were otherwise. That this man, whom I loved, possessed the strength of character to always hear the truth. But who doesn't turn away from the truth now and again? In any event, the facts as he dictated them to me plainly state that he poured himself a fourth bowl of cereal that morning and drank a fifth cup of coffee while ignoring the ringing phone. Then he drifted through the house he dreaded, feeling wiped. He thought a nap might dispel his dark mood, but when he looked at his watch, it was only 10:15. 16. Who was I to judge his sad case? Steady Boy's mother, Delwina, the naive girl with the ugly name, didn't have a clue how to raise a child. Her mother, a pious hypocrite, was no help to her, nor was the man who'd gotten her into trouble. He never once lent a hand. From the moment Charlie came home from the hospital, she was at a loss. The baby never slept. He cried night and day,
and her breasts were open sores. She was just about to go stark raving mad when her fat Aunt Cesarine climbed the 5 stairs to the shanty porch and knocked at the front door. In a moment, I will retell the story Chuck always urged on me of how his parents met and married. This other story of how his great-aunt Cess nearly destroyed him, he told me only once, in passing, but it strikes me as the more interesting of the two and the more revealing. She was an enormous woman, 300 pounds, even allowing for the boutonniere. The majority of that weight resided in her elephantine hips, while her upper body remained as lithe as a little girl's. Taking a fresh pass through family photos, Chuck once joked to me that his great-aunt was all bird above, brontosaurus below. Eternally old, she was born around the time of the Civil War, hit middle age at the turn of the century, and was still alive in 1940, at which point she appeared on Delwina's porch, possessed of an absolute authority. Her niece invited her in, and Cess lowered her immense carriage onto the divan. "Do you always go to the child the minute he starts crying?" her interrogation began. "I always try to, Aunt Cess, that very minute."
"Even when it's just a whimper?"
"Even when I'm asleep, I just bolt upright. He means the world to me."
"And do you pick the child up? Do you soothe him, comfort him?"
"I do try. I don't always know how. He's so unhappy sometimes it just breaks my heart. But I do go to him. I hold him. I kiss him. I do everything I can to make it better."
"Then you are ruining him," Cess declared.
She then presented his mother with a book called Care for the New Baby, which, as far as I can tell, probably determined steady Charles Barnes's fate more than any other single factor, genetic, environmental, you name it.
"What do you know about nervous spoilage?" Cess asked his mother.
Delwina admitted that she knew nothing at all about nervous spoilage.
"That's just as I supposed." Cess shook her head in dismay and added, "You are an ignorant girl."
For the next hour, she tutored Delwina on the mortal dangers of nervous spoilage. It was now scientifically proven there should be no rushing to the baby's side, no picking the baby up with the intention of dispelling a nightmare, no unnecessary holding, pampering, or excessive admiration of the baby. According to Care for the New Baby, those were surefire ways to produce morally weak men.
"This is common knowledge, young lady. Get with the times or that child will be lost."
"Thank you, Aunt Cess."
"Do not dally, girl," she demanded. "Your child's very soul hangs in the balance."
In over her head from day one, Delwina was saved by her aunt's visit and the book she left behind. At last, something to guide her. She began to read Care for the New Baby that very day, and though it was over 400 pages long, and though she was exhausted and had no gift for study, she finished it within the month. It was nothing short of a revelation. She no longer picked Charlie up unnecessarily. She certainly did not hug or kiss him. She did not let his little hand curl over her index finger, the most wonderful sensation of her young life, and a major cause of nervous spoilage. She was instructed to let him cry, and cry he did, through a bad case of whooping cough, through the high fever that accompanied the measles, through rubella, and a flu that almost killed him. He lay alone in his crib, crying for hours. Through the cold nights of his first full winter, when the wind sailed straight through the leaky Westville shanty, he cried. He cried to be cleaned, to be fed, to be held, to be soothed back to sleep. In keeping with the scientific evidence compiled in Care for the New Baby, She did not touch him to excess, or sing or coo when bathing him, or indulge in baby talk. When feeding him, she did not look him in the eye. As the toddler was learning to walk, she did not run to his aid when he fell. Resisting the temptation to weaken his moral character, she turned her back on him and carried on with whatever she was doing. Later, she would tell him how hard it had been. Tormented by his faintest whimpering, she was left brokenhearted, driven nearly insane by his open-throated bawling, and wasn't sure she would survive. Charlie's father woke at dawn, put on his boots and left for work, and was never any help at all. She was alone with Charlie throughout the long day and had to pinch and strike herself so as not to rush immediately to his aid and love him to pieces. Once, a neighbor, the wife of a sharecropper, long compelled by racist hate to mind her own business where white mothers were concerned, nevertheless climbed the shanty steps and knocked at the front door. Was the baby okay? Did the mother need help? Delwina might have simply said no, but she felt it necessary to explain herself. In the absence of Aunt Cess, however, whose conviction she lacked, the lessons imparted by care of the new baby slipped her mind entirely, and for a brief, terrible moment she could not recall the book's logic. She, too, wondered how on earth she could stand by and let a little baby cry. Only after the neighbor was gone did it all come back to her. She was instilling moral character in the child and guaranteeing his future success. A year later, she was pregnant with Rudy. Consumed by morning sickness, she did not have the presence of mind to mark the last time Charlie held up his arms to her out of need, or to ask when he began sucking apathetically on whatever was at hand, a thumb, a shoelace, or why he so often sat dead-eyed in the middle of the kitchen floor. She threw a small baby shower for herself, which Caesarean attended. It was her first opportunity to thank her aunt for the baby book she had given her, as Caesarean had never again returned to the Westville shanty. Without her, Delwina would have done everything wrong. She would have ruined Charlie. She assured her aunt that she would be doing for the new baby everything she had done for Charlie, to avoid the irreparable damage of nervous spoilage.
"That method is now out of date," Aunt Cess declared. "Now it is recommended that you simply hold them."
After that, Delwina smothered all her children with love.